Hey, there he is.
Well, I'm sure Herman's on the fire line somewhere.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Our first order of business today is a work session for the purpose of adoption of rules. We'll open that work session. Paul, would you describe the rules to us? They are available in the meeting materials section of OLS this morning.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and welcome back, members. The rules you have in front of you are exactly the same as the last interim. The only one we've had a little bit of discussion around is the last one on number 10 about when a committee bill, which, of course, your committee will do going into the session, when there's a committee bill introduced, when to have at the request of statement to it. And that's when there's, if it's not a committee member that makes the request, then, or an organization or person outside the committee, then that gets part of that bill introduction, gets part of the title at the request of. So that was just a minor issue that we had discussed a little bit.
Okay. Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the House Interim Committee rules.
Thank you. Representative Vance moves the adoption of the House Interim Committee rules as printed. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. And we'll close the work session. And the committee will stand at ease until the Senate committee has convened and done its business for this morning, and then we'll go on with our business.
Okay. Thank you. We have Senator Riley dialed in.
I will have to dial Senator Riley.
Right. So we can do the thing with code, right? We senators are lazy. We always come to the top of the interim, right? He's recovering, or his wife's recovering. Herman's on the fire line.
That's not an excuse.
Hey. One's burning. I have two fires. One on the edge of two properties. One in Malawi County and one here. So building a fire break on one, loading equipment ready to drive each night to the other side. So, and I'm still here.
My name is Jeff Riley. Sorry I'm not available.
That sucks.
We'll have to just proceed.
I think we need to just go ahead with the hearing. Yeah.
Information meeting. Yeah.
Okay. All right, we will proceed with an informational meeting on the Senate side. And
the House will come back, the House Committee will come back to order for that purpose.
Good morning to everyone. We have the September revenue forecasts. It's been a long time since we've seen each other, almost 2 months. And I do want to say hello to some new members here, Representatives Noose and Helm. Welcome to our scenario.
Thank you.
We won't make you explain what you did last summer or this summer. So let's get right to it, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark McMullen. I'm the state economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis, joined as always by my colleague Josh Lehner to give the economic and revenue outlook. This particular quarterly outlook is a little bit different than the others because, in addition to talking about the upcoming biennium, the 15-17 biennium, and the future resources, we also take a look back and close out the 13-15 biennium, see where we ended in terms of our ending balance and what implications there are for the kicker law, which is what most folks are interested in. So cutting right to the chase in terms of the personal income tax kicker, it's a little bit smaller than it was 3 months ago. We are looking at a kicker on the order of $402 million. which translates to about $124 for the typical tax return filer in the state of Oregon. The kicker number has gone down a little bit because as we ended the last biennium, revenues came in lower than we expected, particularly the big ones, the personal income tax revenues that we are so heavily dependent upon. Essentially, the day after we gave the forecast to you, to this group in May, the revenues just dried up and stopped coming in for a while. A little bit concerning, but now that we've gotten into July, or getting into the new biennium, they've picked back up to the rapid paces we were seeing early in the spring. But the summer was rough, and it was rough both because we saw labor-related taxes, withholdings out of people's paychecks, became very weak. But we also in late May and June, but we also saw a very bad end to the tax return filing season, where I don't know what bad's a value judgment, but a very weak end in terms of fewer collections than we typically see at the end as they finish up processing the last of the returns. So, all in all, We saw revenues in 13-15, or personal income tax revenues, come in about $85 million less than we expected them to. And so this has resulted in a smaller kicker going forward, and, of course, a smaller ending balance. In terms of available resources, the ending balance is down $56 million heading into the new biennium. But luckily, in terms of budget implications, those are largely muted, because not only is the ending balance or the beginning balance coming into the biennium smaller, but the kicker payment that is going to go out, or rather the kicker credit that's going to go out over the next 2 years, is also smaller. So there's this trade-off, which leaves, in general, things pretty much flat, pretty much unchanged in terms of the outlook. And the reason it's unchanged really comes from the fact that we have a very stable economic forecast right now. The consensus of economic forecasters across the U.S., including the vendor that we use, are putting out a very stable outlook from month to month right now. We're seeing very, very small changes. And so, and given that our advisory groups aren't really pushing for any changes as well, this stable outlook is feeding through into a stable outlook for revenues as well. So in terms of the economy, the big thing how long can it be stable, obviously? That's what we're looking for now that we're well into a mature expansion. The question is, when will it end? And I get this question almost daily. Well, we've been going now for months and months. We're looking at many months more than the average. Here we see the average post-war recession goes 58 months. We're already well above that. So are we due, in a sense? Are we due for something? Well, the academic literature says there is no such thing as being due, that expansions don't really die of old age, that the probability of going into a recession is not dependent upon how long the expansions have been going on over history. And so that's somewhat encouraging, and we even have a historical example here, or our experience between the last very severe recession we had in the early 1980s. We went about 20 years at that time without a revenue event. There was a U.S. recession in 1991, and it drug Oregon down with it somewhat, but it was very mild here, and we got a big influx of folks from California in particular that got hit particularly hard with base closures and the like, military base closures and the like down there. And so as a result, we didn't really see revenues fall in that recession in terms of state resources. They stopped growing, but we didn't really see the kind of contraction that we're dealing with now. So we got a good almost 20 years between the 1980s recession and the tech bust, where there was really no trauma on state resources. And so it's certainly possible. And the other issue is recessions tend to come after the economy is heated up. Basically, we get out over our skis at some point and then are in a little bit of danger. And it really doesn't look like we are out over our skis at this point. Particularly, you look at a lot of typical economic indicators. Do we have just, you know, modest output or gross domestic product growth? We're seeing just really slow wage gains, not much inflation. This isn't what an economy usually looks like when it's overheating and we have a lot of speculative stuff going on. The best, in terms of the most optimistic or the indicator that would suggest that we're closest to heating up would be the unemployment rate, which you see here, has come down significantly, even though we've had a little bit of uptick in terms of the most recent data that Josh will talk about a little bit. But as you see here, after the unemployment rate gets down to what is a normal level, or what here we call it full employment, but it's basically what you would think about a long-term trend without inflation is what we're really looking at. But in the last couple of business cycles, we've had 3 or 4 years where we get below this, where we are now, the high 5% in unemployment rate. You know, we get down below that into the low fives and even the high fours. And at that point, you know, that obviously is not sustainable forever. But typically we need a little bit of that time, a little bit of that heat up before we have a full-blown recession. We really aren't getting that yet. But at some point, it's not that it isn't possible, but it's certainly much less likely. Once we get into a situation where we have a lot of speculative behavior, where we have a lot of people cutting it close and sticking their necks out, then we can have a Wile E. Coyote moment where we realize that we're out over the cliff and everyone pulls back at once, and that's the recessionary dynamic. That's that self-fulfilling prophecy part of it that kicks in. But it doesn't look like we're there yet, even when we look at our most optimistic numbers, which are the unemployment rate. But wouldn't suggest you look too much at the unemployment rate recently, because the numbers are a little goofy, as Josh will explain.
Before we get to some of the unemployment rate, for the record, Josh Lanner, Office of Economic Analysis. While we don't believe the U.S. economy or the Oregon economy is out over its skis at the moment or is overheating and is due for a recession, that doesn't mean there aren't major issues in the global economy more broadly. Just in the last couple of weeks, we've had some turmoil. A lot of it is emanating from China in particular, but global economic growth more broadly. You can see the graph in front of you just shows the outlook for China is a lot lower than it has been basically in 20 years. And there's concerns that China has gone through now three major bubbles in the last decade. First, a local government bubble. Then they had a housing bubble, and now they've had a stock bubble that's been crashing in the last month or 2 months. And typically these bubbles, they don't end well. And so the concern is we'll have some sort of hard landing in China, not just a relative slowdown like you see in front of you, but there'll be a much more drastic event that would send a big shockwave through the global economy. That's the concern. A lot of other economic data from China shows slowing, but no outright recession as of today. If you look at rail car usage or if you look at electricity consumption, things like that, again, you see slowing, but not a free-for-all, at least not yet. So this is a big concern. And so what's going to happen, particularly as Oregon has stronger ties, manufacturing ties with China and the Pacific Rim countries more broadly. Besides a slowdown in the global growth, which might hurt some consumption of Oregon-made products, if we go to the next slide, the bigger concern overall is the strengthening dollar along these lines. In the last year or two, the U.S. dollar and an Oregon equivalent, where we kind of rebalance exchange rates based on our trading patterns, because we trade with more Pacific Rim countries than the U.S. overall does, that sort of thing, it's up 20% or so. It's appreciated. The dollar is 20% more stronger today than it was a year and a half ago or so. And so that's really hurting, it's making our products more expensive in the global world. It's making products made abroad less expensive to American buyers. So we're going to see more imports, less exports, and that could take the wind out of the sails of the manufacturing sector. Another graph you see in front of you is manufacturing employment in Oregon today is growing at 4%. That's a really strong number, and it hasn't really slowed down as of yet. We're continuing to add some wood products jobs, some timber-related jobs, in addition to metals makers, in addition to our aerospace industry, and tech producers have added jobs. We're seeing strong growth relatively strong growth across the board in our manufacturing industry. Food products, food processing is exceptionally strong in the last couple of years. And so these are the types of industries you would expect to see will be impacted the most by a stronger dollar moving forward. And so that's a concern in terms of being a weak point in the outlook moving forward should these sort of events continue to go on.
That's right, and it's really a threat both in the near and the long term. As Josh mentioned, our manufacturers have heavy ties to Asia right now, and so any reduction in demand is going to hit us disproportionately hard. But also, it's an issue in the long run. A lot of our major employers are looking to the Chinese consumer as the source of demand growth going forward over the next decade or two, and it's, for now at least, the China and the policymakers there have postponed or stalled their attempts to shift into a more consumer-oriented economy, and we've also seen a tremendous amount of wealth losses among the middle class in China in terms of their stock market correction. And so right now, a lot of, you know, in terms of our longer-term sales and demand for our products, looks like it's at threat as well.
A quick question on that note, since you're there. There's benefits, though, to the U.S. in shrinking the trade gap, right, with a stronger dollar. Do those benefits counter the disadvantages of having Oregon goods be more expensive?
Yes, Senator Haas. Typically, the trade gap will shrink if we get a weaker dollar, because in that case, it makes our products cheaper for people abroad to buy and their products more expensive for us to buy. So in terms of the gap, that shrinks. But your point is well taken, because it's not an unequivocally good thing. You know, a strong dollar has benefits as well for the domestic economy as well. So, and at some point, like you say, for consumers, when we have a strong dollar, our consumers and our businesses who buy products abroad see a reduction in their costs. So it's clearly not an entirely bad thing to see a strong dollar by any means. But in terms of the direct effect on trade, it does slow your exports.
Thank you.
Could I follow up on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oregon, I think it's still the case that Oregon is one of the, as a percentage of our total economy, manufacturing is a bigger chunk for us than it is for most states. And therefore, anything that affects our ability to export might have a disproportionate effect on Oregon.
Yes, absolutely, Representative Barnard. We're among the top in terms of manufacturing, and particularly in our urban areas, our metropolitan areas have more exposure to manufacturing than the typical state as well.
So follow up, if I could, quickly. So that's why you're spending so much time on this issue, I assume, is that this is one of the risks that you're going to tell us about later.
Yeah, absolutely, Representative Barnard. And when we talk about Asia, that's really what hits Oregon particularly hard. You know, over our post-war history, in every, you know, peacetime expansion, Oregon grows faster than does the typical state, except for one little period in the late 1990s when we had the Asian financial crisis, and it really hit our supply chains, and our particular trading partners were the epicenter of the problem. And in that case, we lagged behind other states. That's sort of the thing we're concerned about here. The typical economists, although some are very, very worried about China, but a lot of economists say, well, we're still this big monster of an economy, the U.S. We feed ourselves. We don't need the rest of the world to keep growing. But even if that's true, if we have these problems in Asia, Oregon will lose its growth advantage vis-a-vis other states, even if the country continues to expand. So here's the one that kept us up this weekend, where the turmoil in equity markets, which the narrative out there is that it is coming from China and from the Chinese equity markets to begin with. Not clear how much that is true. There's been a long time now that folks have been talking about, well, when the Federal Reserve starts tightening rates or starts raising rates, we're going to see a lot of the wind come out of the sails of the stock market. And this has been kind of conventional wisdom, you know, in a lot of investment houses. Well, we're getting darn close to the Fed increasing rates. And so, you know, what we're seeing in China may well have been a coordinating event for investors across the globe to kind of pull back. Hopefully they won't pull back by very much. Because of the dynamics of the way stocks interact with the Oregon state budget and the timing of our budget process makes this a little sketchy. Because what happens in a sell-off of stocks is initially we see our revenues go up. Because as folks are pulling their money out of the markets, they're taking some taxable gains. While stock prices are going down, they may be selling and typically are selling for more than they bought for, and so we generate a lot of taxable events when we sell off the stock market. But then in following years, then we have a hangover. At that point, now we have losses that carry forward into time, and then there's no more stock of gains to be realized, and we can have these huge swings, never more pronounced than we saw during the last recession, when we went from around $10 billion a year in realized capital gains to $2 billion in just over the course of a couple of years. So obviously, this is one of the most volatile parts of our revenue forecast. Here we've put in. This weekend, we went ahead and put in some of this stock market swing. We didn't buy in all of it, and very well may turn out to be bigger than this. This, as we have here, as you see, is more like a hiccup rather than a full-blown stock market crash that could potentially ensue. And if it does become worse than this boom-bust swing you see here in our new forecast, this is problematic because of the timing of where we are. Because we're just starting a biennium right now. And so if we, should stock markets suffer a sharp correction, by that I mean a large loss, double-digit sort of loss, at that point we're going to see a whole lot of revenue here the first half of the biennium and then potentially really nothing or very little in the second half. And the reason that's so problematic is that policymakers have no time to adjust. Once the biennium gets mature, any adjustments they make in terms of cutting spending or increasing taxes or revenues only have a few months with which to bear fruit. When most of the money has already come in or out, there's very little that policymakers can do. And we had a terrible experience during the technology recession of just that, where the bottom fell out on revenues at the end of a biennium. There was no time to make adjustments, though we had to borrow our way out. And now, after a decade, we just finally cleared that off of the books. And so, you know, given the timing and what we're seeing here and the volatility in the stock market, this is an issue right now. But we've taken a little bit of a step there now towards that direction. And as we head into the even year session, rebalance session, hopefully we'll have a better picture of where this is going to be for you. But for now, despite the risk to these non-wage forms of income and the stock markets and the like, employment growth in Oregon is doing very well. As Josh mentioned, manufacturing at 4% year over year. Our mid-sized metropolitan areas really have never grown faster. We have a lot going on for us. And in general, we always do. As I mentioned before, here we don't go back all the way to post-war, but Oregon, when we're growing, we outperform the typical state. Our problem, of course, is when everyone's not growing, we outperform the typical state then as well. But here we are. We've up to, you know, over 3% employment growth year over year once again, well above that of the typical state, and some of the same reasons as has always been the case. As Representative Barnhart pointed out, we still have a large degree of exposure to manufacturers and natural resource industries and producers of goods. These are always very boom-bust industries, and as these boom, we boom bigger. And In addition to that, we are also seeing our traditional advantage in terms of migration trends have, by all accounts, have returned and then some. We look at driver's licenses given up to the DMV and school enrollment records and the like, and it appears that the flow in from California in particular and other states is back up to what we saw in the best of the last couple of cycles.
Senator Buckley.
Would you just comment briefly, since Happy Days are here again, that only covers 11 counties? I have the state's unemployment report here. And so 11 counties have returned to, you know, pre-recession levels, and the other 25 remain under those levels. Is that not correct?
Yes, Senator Boquist, that sounds very much correct to me. There are some counties that haven't returned to 1980 levels yet in our state. Okay. So we still definitely have this divide. But that said, we are starting to see every rural region, not every county, but if we group them into regions, every single rural region in Oregon now is adding a few jobs. Not a whole lot, but over the last year, we've really become more broad-based and spread out across the state. Again, they lag behind our metropolitan areas, but we are starting to see some encouraging signs. And some of the forward-looking stuff is encouraging as well. We're seeing increase in business formations in a lot of the rural areas. We're seeing increases in help wanted ads in rural areas, and we're seeing a lot of increases in driver's license turned in.
Follow up. And following up on Representative Barnhart's observation earlier, how much of that job growth is manufacturing related?
Yes, Senator Boquist. Not a whole lot. I mean, obviously, in some towns it is. We have, you know, some success stories, and particularly in food and resources, we have a couple of, you know, obviously every town is different. But as with the rest of the state, we're seeing more growth in the rural areas on either end of the wage spectrum. A lot of low-wage jobs, a lot of high-wage jobs, some professional services and the like. But these manufacturing jobs and the middle wage stuff in the middle is still a little bit weak. So with that, we get a little bit wonky and technical here and talk a little bit about the most recent unemployment numbers.
Thank you. Could you go back to your previous slides just for a second? You commented just in obliquely on that trend line, which I think you've mentioned. It looks like over the last 20 years, these recessions become more difficult. Is that the right word? So what is that? Is that just a charting exercise? What are we seeing there?
Well, they've certainly become deeper. Our recessions, the first graph, I'm sorry to go back on you, but we have kind of seen in our recent recessions, 91, 2000, and this one, the expansions at least are longer and weaker than they used to be. When we start in the early 1990s and throughout the 90s, the conventional wisdom among economists is that we figured this out, that because we're better at monetary and fiscal policy making now, we've smoothed these business cycles so that they're fewer and farther between, and when we do have them, they're milder. Well, the experience of the 2000s kind of changed that perception, and now we've seen some real doozies. But even though we've taken these big hits, and in particular this last one, a huge cyclical hit, we're not seeing that V-shaped swing that we used to get back in the good old manufacturing days and whatnot, where we would bounce back very quickly. As you see, it's a long haul, and we're just now getting full employment.
Follow up. Yeah, thank you. So I'm just curious: is there any lesson to be drawn from, if you can go back to the other slide on the employment, that right there? So it looks as though the situation grows more grim each time we go through this. Is there a reason that you can share with us why that is the case?
Representative Vance, we've cut off the 1980 recession here. That kind of would have changed the perception. We have in 1980, when the timber industry restructured, we saw population losses in Oregon, which is unheard of, and a swing just about every bit as big as that 2007 one. We need to go back about 5 or 10 years to get an accurate picture here. But that said, absolutely, that first one is a big one. The last one is a big one. And it's also the case that in terms of how high we get in terms of the growth is slowing over time, largely due to demographic factors and labor force. We don't expect to grow at the pace we've become accustomed to. However, here we are matching the best of the housing boom, at least for the moment.
Thank you. Just a quick update on the unemployment rate. You might have noticed in the most recent reports, the unemployment rate plunged considerably to start the year. We were seeing record levels of unemployment rate decline, something the state had never seen before, and in the last few months it's ticked back up. A lot of that has to do underlying noisy data, sampling errors, things like that. It's before it gets revised and smoothed out over time, it can get these big swings. This is more volatility than we're used to seeing, but you can see we're right back on sort of that slow, steady decline in the unemployment rate trend that we've seen in recent years, and in both in our last forecast and this forecast before the latest reports were coming out, we had the unemployment rate ticking back up to 6% and then kind of going back down to 5.5%. So when you see these sort of volatilities in these measures, it usually has to do, to be frank with you, data issues and not necessarily the underlying economic conditions. With that being said, we've seen considerable improvements in the underlying economic conditions in terms of job growth, and most of that is in the metropolitan areas, there's no question. But we're seeing some growth return across the states, stronger wage gains, pickup, population growth, our job gains. I think if we go to the next slide, and this one's probably more important in the sense that we're adding a whole lot of jobs today, but the migration flows have returned. Are we making progress? Are we adding jobs faster than we're adding people? And the answer is yes. Here we're talking about the share of the prime working age population that has a job. We're only about 40% recovered by this measure. We're right along with the typical state. We lost, 5% of people used to have a job before the Great Recession. They lost their job. And then so far we've picked up about 2 of those 5 percentage points. And so, yes, we're seeing strong growth. But we're also making progress on the economic damage from the Great Recession. It's been slower, but we are getting there. And so this is encouraging here, is that we're definitely making progress.
And the other encouraging place we're making progress is on wages. At the national level, folks are still waiting for wage growth to pick up. And in particular, this is what our monetary policymakers are pointing towards as, what we need before we can start raising rates and getting to a more normal footing in terms of monetary policy. But in terms of Oregon, we've started to see wages grow strongly here over the last year or so, and certainly pick up relative to other states. Here you see, in terms of our average wage, is now 92 or 93%. Of the typical state, which is higher than it's been ever since the timber industry restructured in the 1980s. We've never had, our relative income has never been this close. The per capita personal income, when we go away from the job market and add all the other investment type income and transfer incomes from, government programs and the like, Oregon never looks as good. We don't have financial centers or the real wealthy folks or whatnot, so our per capita personal income measures are low, and also we don't we haven't shown up as much on some of these proprietor's income and pass-through type incomes as other states, and I suspect it has to do with our dependence on the personal income tax and incentive to maybe not file that way here relative to other states. But nevertheless, even per capita personal income as a relative to other states is rising as well. But the fact that our wages, our relative wages are as high as they've been since the 1980s is certainly remarkable.
Just real quickly, about the labor force participation, the rate is at an all-time low right now, at least going back 4 decades. A lot of that is demographic-driven. There's certainly an economic weakness component here, and I believe we've talked about this before in forecast releases past. What we really care about here in terms of measuring the health of the economy and the potential for the economy moving forward is the difference between the red and the gray lines. The saying that we're at an all-time low in the labor force participation rate in and of itself doesn't tell you that much. We probably should should be, again, with the aging population. As you move in from your 40s to your 50s to your 60s, certainly to your 70s, the share of the population that is working or wants a job falls considerably. Those 65 years and older, somewhere 16-18% of them have a job, or even in the labor force, I think they have a 1% unemployment rate, because you're either working because you want to or you have to for financial reasons, or you're retired. There's not too many unemployed 70-year-olds that are out there. But besides the point, you know, here we're seeing continued weakness, and this is probably the worst economic indicator you can find. While the unemployment rate itself might be the best, the labor force participation rate is probably the worst. And they kind of – they come from the same data, and so they play off of each other. And so it's no surprise to see that they're on opposite ends of the spectrum. However, in 2014, we made some okay progress, some decent progress in the labor force participation rate. We're expecting to see another uptick of another percentage point or so in closing this participation gap in our outlook. Once the data is revised, I highlighted there again when the last good data point is, you can see the data's plunged since then. I think that, again, that's an underlying data volatility issue that I wouldn't make too much of. However, more people giving up looking for work than you would expect is not a good sign, and so we're sort of waiting for this to show some continued improvement to prove or to show that the economy is fully healthy again.
Excuse me, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how does this compare to the national?
Representative, relative to the national average, we're below average right now. For all of our history in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we were in two. First part of the 2000s, we were above the U.S. average. Since about 2005, we're now below the U.S. average. And some of that, again, is some of it's demographics, because we have an extra large baby boomer cohort. Our baby boomers in Oregon are a larger share than in the typical state. I think that's part of it. But, again, we had a much more severe Great Recession, and so that has certainly played a factor.
Yeah, Representative, and we've also seen our advantage in terms of participation among the youngest workers erode over this time, too, which is, I think, a little more troubling. Back to more troubling bad news. As we mentioned before with Senator Boquist, rural areas certainly have not performed as well over the recession and recovery as has the rest of the state. Here we just do a simple split between our metropolitan areas and our rural areas, and this is employment. It starts on the left, where at 0% was just before we went into the Great Recession and we were at our jobs peak. And then as we went through the recession, both urban areas and rural areas suffered equally, losing roughly 8% of their jobs. But since then, obviously the experience has been split, you know, led by the Portland area and the Columbia Gorge. Urban Oregon bounced back fairly quickly and steadily ever since it bottomed out, whereas rural area, it took 2 or 3 years before construction startups started coming back and the cuts around K-12 started stopping before we finally started to see some climb up in terms of rural Oregon employment. And as I mentioned, this is really everywhere in the state, but not every county, but when we add the regions up together, they're all starting to turn around. And not only that, but a lot of the more forward-looking indicators are looking good as well. Obviously, rural Oregon faces a tremendous amount of challenges still, but the job growth we've seen in the last year and a half lends a little bit more hope. The other thing that lends hope is educational attainment. There's a coastal caucus that Dr. Warner and I are going to later this afternoon on education in the rural areas, and it was shocking to me that every single, if you exclude the 65 and older folks, the ones who may not be in the prime working ages, every single one of our coastal counties has a higher rate of educational attainment than the typical rural area in the U.S. And this is particularly surprising given that they've been hit so much harder. Our coastal counties have been taking a hit to their resource industries on the order of what, you know, Detroit and Youngstown went through. But yet at the same time, we're really kind of holding our own relative to other rural areas. And so this is encouraging, to say the least. So, as you see here, over the long term, we're really starting pulling down the typical growth rate that we've seen. I've put this graph up before you folks before, so I won't hammered into the ground, but as the labor force participation rate stopped growing over time and then started shrinking as we get into the 2000s, we've really seen this trend growth rate, or what we tend to average during expansions, weaken. And we expect that to be true going forward. And we feel very strongly about our medium to long-term forecast that we just aren't going to be able to maintain the same rates that we used to. The primary issue behind this is the aging of the workforce, the baby boom population cohort, which is really an army of very, very skilled workers with a lifetime of experience, are pulling out of the workforce, and this is going to put a lid on our growth here for the next 10 or 15 years. But so as you see here, in the end of the day, we're getting down to a trend growth rate of 1%, and we can come at it with all kinds of different models or all different kinds of methodologies, and we get to this idea that that's going to be sort of where we end up. And we, you know, our advisors come at it from different angles as well, and they're coming to that same sort of conclusion. But given the input from our advisory group that the near term is really great, everything's awesome, and we're going to be going for the next year or two at this great growth rate that we're seeing now, and melding that with this concept that as we go into the medium to long term, we're not going to see great growth rates, this outlook, as you see here, it's beginning to pass the eye test more and more, which means, you know, in terms of looking like one of these past business cycles. Now, we don't forecast recessions, so you see here we're not going down into recession territory, but nevertheless, this is more curvature and timing than we typically have in an economic model, because it's molding what our models are telling us about the long term with what our advisors are telling us about bullish about the short term. But this does leave us a little exposed because timing, you know, timing of the budget cycle, where does it land, and does this slowdown occur when we say it does, or, you know, in which budget period does that happen? So we're going to keep an eye on it, but most folks that just take a look at the picture like it a lot more now than they did when it looked more like a straight line outlook. This fits people's sniff test a little bit more. It's just leaves us a little bit exposed in terms of the timing of when this is going to slow down. So what we really care about, the kicker, we'll talk a little bit about 15-17 as well, but that hasn't changed very much. But as I said, as we ended the biennium, personal income taxes came in very low, and so this reduced our kicker to $402 million. Now here we've made the calculation for what this would mean to the typical taxpayer. So these aren't people, these are filers or tax returns. And so for the typical tax return, we're looking at a credit of $124. Again, for those of you who haven't been here, it's been a decade since the last kicker. They used to be all the time. But now, instead of getting a check, the legislature changed it to a credit on tax returns. So folks, when they file their tax returns in April of 2016 or thereabouts, we'll be seeing a credit around this size, depending on how much you paid in 2014. It's pegged to what you paid in 2014. So since it's a function of what you paid, there's considerable movement here as we go through the income distribution. For the top 1% of folks who are making over $330,000 a year, we're looking at a kicker check of a credit of roughly $4,600. So fairly sizable from an individual taxpayer standpoint in terms of the state budget impact, less than you've become accustomed to. $400 million is about a third of what the last kicker we put out in 2007 was. And at that point, the economy was considerably smaller. So this one won't feel as bad in terms of the budgetary impact, nor will it feel as good for the folks getting the money back. In terms of the corporate kicker, that is also still in kicker territory. But we need to iron out the methodology on the corporate kicker before we certify the exact amount. There's been some, for both the personal and the corporate kicker, there's been some changes in methodology over the last three or four 4 months, and we need to find out what the we need to pull some people together and find out the appropriate one for the corporate kicker at this time. Briefly, it the methodological change has to do with general fund carve-outs, how we treat those in terms of the kicker law. When I say carve-outs, what I'm talking about are the Measure 67 related rainy day fund transfer from minimum taxes and the returning of tax money to localities for the gain share program. These are carve-outs that happen before the revenue process. But as part of the debate around Senate reforms this session, in particular, the effort to maybe carve out some of our most volatile capital gains revenue off of the general fund, it was determined by legislative counsel that this is not these carve-outs should not be excluded from the kicker calculations. That when the kicker was put into the Constitution in 2000 by voters, the voters they believed that general fund, which is the language of the kicker, was interchangeable with income taxes, and so we can carve out cigarette distributions, but we can't carve out any income taxes out of the kicker calculation. You can dedicate the spending, but it doesn't affect the net kicker calculation. So in this case, it makes a large difference for the corporate kicker, because in the special session, the rainy day fund deposit was delayed 1 year, and so increased the general fund in the near term. So now, going forward, given what we've heard about the interpretation of the law, we're now going with just looking at the gross flows in of the income taxes in terms of our kicker calculation. So the corporate kicker is yet to come. It'll be somewhere between $60 and $80 million in terms of the value, depending on which methodology we settle upon. So that closes out 13-15. Going forward into 15-17, the outlook is pretty stable. We have increased resources relative to the May forecast, but largely that has to do with enacted changes during the session, revenue enhancements during the session. Overall, the economically driven revenues have gone down slightly since our last forecast.
So if I could, Mr. Chair, thank you. Which making certain I understand. The little red bar are changes generated by legislative action.
Yes, Representative Barnard, I should have been clear at this. To read this chart, as we go from the left to the right, these are different quarterly forecasts, December 10th being the first one that I personally prepared. And so we see as we go across time where our outlook for 2015-17 has been. Now, this hasn't actually been used until December of 2014 was the first time this actually got used in the governor's recommended budget, but this kind of shows you where, you know, our long-term guidance has been. And so, yes, so the red section are all the revenue enhancements that were generated by the legislature during the 2015 session. The biggest chunk of that is the PEB fund shift, which is, I think, $120 million along those lines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So in terms of what we're seeing in taxes, as I mentioned, boy, when we gave the stuff in early May, things were really looking up. Our personal income taxes were up, you know, 15% year over year. They've cooled down to the 9 or 10% rate since then. It was very, very abrupt how fast the collection stopped coming in. But that said, in terms of our indicators of labor market income and the personal income taxes as we've headed into 15-17 have picked right back up. So the next real period of uncertainty is going to be here in the next month or two as folks, the high-income folks who file amended and extended returns hit that fall deadline. And we're going to to what extent does this weakness in the end of the filing period, to what does that foreshadow, you know, folks not paying a whole lot in the extension period as well and getting larger returns is an open question. We're a little bit concerned about it as our accountants are as we head into the fall. In terms of corporate collections, those too have stopped coming in. They've become very stable. I use the word flatline here. I've had an editor tell me flatline you can't use as a verb, and or crater for that matter. I like to use crater as a verb too, but that's not correct. But at any rate, the corporate collections are not increasing anymore, but they're still way up there. And so we still have quite a bit of uncertainty in this outlook. Now, profits are still way up there, but at the same time, we've had a lot of legislative changes going in to this number, and we've had a change in the processing system at DOR. And since that change in the processing system, we've taken this new step up. This isn't where we think we're going to land. We think we're going to land at more $550 million a year rather than the $600 million a year here. That's what we have embedded into the revenue outlook. But it's still an open question, and we have to wait to see, I think, once we get a year or so of this new system in and see what the processing timing and the differences there are. But I think it will come down. July and August in particular were extremely weak. July, about half the size of July last year in terms of corporate collections. So right now we're going to stick with the outlook that we're going to come down and settle in around the $550 million dollars a year range, but waiting for more data to see.
One other revenue stream for the state of Oregon. More broadly, we've been waiting for consumer spending to pick up following low oil prices, low gasoline prices. We haven't really seen it. We've seen an increase in savings among many U.S. households, and that's where a lot of the gas savings have been going. Another place we think we're seeing it is in gaming more broadly. First, we saw the Oregon video lottery sales start to turn around. They implemented what they're calling a capital replacement program. They're replacing all the different video lottery terminals you see at your favorite bar or restaurant with new ones. Some of these are a decade old or so. By the time they get replaced, they're upgrading to new technologies and new games and all those sorts of wonderful things when it comes to capital improvements. And so we saw our sales pick up, and then we started to look more broadly at some of the other gaming markets that we track, which have been doing very poorly in the last decade, along with Oregon lottery sales have been down and flat in recent years. However, we're seeing an uptick almost everywhere across the casinos and racinos nationwide. And so I think it's pointing to a broader spectrum or a broader indicator than just the new machines. Of course, the Oregon numbers are the strongest we're seeing in the last year. So I think the new machines are players are finding the new machines to be something that they want to play. And so we're seeing an uptick in sales. Of course, the exception here being Atlantic City. They've been down for years and years and years, and there's no end in sight. Everywhere else, though, seeing 2-4% revenue growth. Las Vegas is up to 6% revenue growth in the last year, and then Oregon, we're at 10%. And so I think, again, it points to a broader economic improvement or consumer confidence that they're willing to spend their disposable income on something such as gaming.
Question, Senator Boquist.
I actually have two now. First off, where are you buying your gas since you're getting low gas prices? Because it hasn't gone down in my district. That's the first question. But the second thing, the Oregon video lottery, in discussions with our tribal national colleagues across the way in the state, tribal gambling revenues are down, and Oregon lottery video revenues are up. Any speculation on why? People just not traveling the distance to go to the casinos, or
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, to the tribal gaming point, the tribes used to put out a consolidated gaming report, economic impact statement, and when they got down to about a 13% decline a few years ago from peak, they stopped publishing it. Oregon lottery fell 20-25%, and so there's weakness in the gaming market nationwide. And so even though we're up 10% in the last year, we're still below where we were, right? So lottery and gaming more broadly seems to have turned the corner in the last year, and we're seeing some decent growth numbers again, but they're still way below where they were. Tribal gaming, we have some tribal gaming numbers from other states, New Mexico being one that publishes very detailed data by the tribes. It's not looking great either. So I'm not surprised, given every other gaming numbers we can have, that our tribal casinos are not doing exceptionally well. How poorly or mediocre are they doing? I don't know, because it's not publicly data in recent years. But again, I think it's an industry trend where it's a very discretionary type of spending, and you have to feel confident enough, or your economic situation has to be good enough that you're willing to say, I'm going to go lose 92 cents on the dollar, if you will, on this type of thing. And people, you know, do it for entertainment. And so we saw broader entertainment spending turn around first, or at least stabilize. You know, if you look at museum attendance or sporting event attendance or gym memberships or these other sort of things that are, again, our discretionary items, those stabilized first. And now we're starting to see gaming come along a couple years later and sort of follow the same pattern, if that makes sense.
Back to cheap gas, or not. I think we're at 39 this morning on the market, which is it's the lowest in 9 years. But we're not seeing a pump change from, you know, it's basically floating around $3 a gallon for gasoline in Oregon, when it could be at $2 a gallon. And my question is not beating up the oil companies or why, but if the price, the purchase price of the pump does go down, even 50 cents or whatever along that line, do you see that from a state economic position as more consumer spending in the state? Do you see it as an equal flow? Or what do you think the economic impact would be if prices do go down another 50 cents a gallon?
Absolutely. Yeah, Senator Boquist, it would be good. I mean, in terms of every business and every household in the state consumes energy, and in particular gasoline is one that's a big part of budget. So absolutely, if it goes down to where they claim it will, you know, in the $2 range or something, where future markets are, you know, that would be quite a boon. Now, who knows if they are? Your observation is absolutely correct, how this is divorced from market forces. In terms of gasoline, these refinery bottlenecks, you know, mess up the supply, you know, in each region of the country, and so that, you know, sometimes there's a real disconnect between current prices and oil prices. But that said, it'll help. But it hasn't really at $3 yet. And a lot of people are talking about, well, what's going on? You know, we're supposed to see, you know, we've got a lot cheaper than it was at $4. So where's this boost to consumer spending? We're really not seeing a whole lot of retail sales pump up or anything like that as a result. And a little back of the envelope stuff that I've done, I think the root of the matter is, you know, when you look at the overall spending power of households, while the lower energy prices are helping, that's being offset right now by higher housing costs. Rents are very high, and the cost of single-family housing is so high right now that I think, you know, every dollar that they're saving in terms of gas is going towards the rent right now. But should we go down to $2, and since rents have topped out, and I would think that we really will see some flavor for spending, which is why we're looking at this lottery. You know, obviously video lottery, although it's the biggest part of the lottery, you know, this isn't the biggest revenue item that drives the state budget. But we always look at it because, you know, we're not a sales tax state, so we don't get good data on this, you know, real-time consumer spending. We get video lottery sales. We get some, you know, lodging taxes, a little bit of this. Now we're about to get the marijuana, too, but we don't have a whole lot of, you know, and the prepaid cell phones we'll have, but we don't have a lot of real consumer real-time data.
Thank you.
So for the changes, I'm sorry, this is changes from each of these different forecasts relative to May, and as you see, the lion's share of the differences have to do with the legislative change, which is the other category, in particular the fund shift of $120 million there you see in 15-17. The only other thing really moving the needle here are personal income taxes, the red bar. 13-15, as I've explained, came in about $85 million less than we expected. So that's down. And then you see it's also down as we get out into 19-21 is a significant down. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is this swing in stock prices that we put in now. We put in this little up and down hiccup, and that has a hangover, which really starts to hit out in those out years. That swing in stock prices is even bigger than, in terms of the capital gains, is even bigger than what we've put in, you know, in terms of the stock prices. We have, in addition to just in any sell-off, you're going to see more taxable events and then less. We have some idiosyncratic things going on in Oregon that are going to pump up these capital gains and non-wage income. In particular, a lot of our homegrown companies have sold over the last year. We had Precision Cast Pots and the Standard and the little ones, Dave's Bread and 10 Barrel Brewing and Stumptown Coffee, and all these are going to create some taxable events for some shareholder employees that are going to show up on the books. And the other thing that's going to pump it up is some philanthropic gifts that we expected to hit the impact of these, although gifts themselves aren't taxable. You know, no one has, you know, $100 million in their checking account, so you create, by liquidating assets in order to make gifts, you create taxable events. And we expected some of the large ones to come in the last budget period that didn't, that are going to show up in the next tax year. So these idiosyncratic events, in addition to the sell-off, we're starting to put a little bit of a big 2015 tax year week, 2016-17, in the mix here. And the other thing that's going on in 1921 and beyond is reforms to the gain share program. Hmm. Gain share was capped by the legislature, but in addition to capping the gain share program, the sunset was also extended. And as of the last forecast, it sunsetted no more payments from fiscal 19 and beyond. Now those payments continue, and so we've reduced our available resources here for that as well. But again, over the long run, the story is we're going to land at slower rates of growth than we've become accustomed to. Right now, we're last biennium, we're looking at almost 14% growth. Yeah. That'll transition down into the nines and tens as this employment growth slows down into the 1% range. And as you see here, it's the transition is nice and smooth in terms of our outlook for revenue growth, unlike the history, which has not been smooth, where we have recessions involved. Actually, the timing was a little bit different than this. The reason it looks like 11-13 had the fastest revenue growth of the period had more to do with the legislature than it had to do with the economy. The legislature at that point, because we had huge budget gaps, were doing all they could to bring in more money and one-time actions and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of supplemental funds. So those pumped up general fund growth in 11-13, but underlying economic growth was, you know, was weaker than we've seen here in the last biennium. So with that, that's all we have for prepared comments, but we'd be happy to take any more questions if you have them.
Thank you. We do have some questions. I do want to go back a few slides. One of the elusive goals on this committee and this state was to try to raise the income up closer to the average. We're at 90s. And you said we made some progress there. Was that just it's always been kind of a chicken and egg. How do we get there? But we've made some progress. Is that just a general economic improvement, or is there a specific reason?
Yes, Senator Hass. It's general economic improvement insofar as, again, we have this growth advantage. And the biggest erosion that a lot of folks were pointing to in terms of Oregon's relative incomes was this decade of the 2000s. Well, there was two huge recessions during the decade of the 2000s, which Oregon never keeps up when we have big recessions. And so now that we're into this long 7-year expansion that we've had, we're starting to see, you know, our relative wages increase relative to everyone else. This happened, of course, during the 1990s as well. So the longer this expansion goes on, the better we're going to look relative to the typical state.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Davis.
Thank you, and thank you both very much for all your work and for a great presentation. I'd like to focus on slide 10 and 12, in particular the Oregon labor force participation rate, comparing the demographically adjusted level, which we talked a little bit about some of Oregon's aging demographics, but it's slide 10, I think that's the most concerning then, because here we're sort of taking out the youth unemployment and retiree employment and still seeing about a 5% reduction in prime working age employment. Can you speak to some of the fundamentals of why that might be occurring? And is that playing into some of the lower growth trends that you're projecting?
Representative Data, Mr. Chair, absolutely. The fact that, again, you know, we're adding so many jobs today, trying to make up the lost ground from the Great Recession. We just did, you know, a handful of months ago, we finally surpassed the peak of where we were. But of course, the population has continued to grow, and so this kind of nets that out. How much of it's, you know, are we still making up lost ground? And you can see it's still only a partial recovery. And to the extent that it doesn't become a full recovery, both in a labor force participation rate sense or as a share of the people with the job, that you would think will lower trend growth moving forward, because there's we're not utilizing all of our resources as we can, or you know, we have a lot of people, able-bodied people, that should or would be able to work, and we're not employing them, and so therefore our productive capacity is lower, and that is a concern. This graph is a half empty, half full type of look at it, and it's certainly not a purely good story in the fact that we're not all the way back to the same share of the working age population that has a job as before the Great Recession.
Follow up. And the first half of my question, sorry, it was a compound question, was fundamentals of why this might be, why we might see a quarter of the prime working age population, even in an uptick recovery, not working?
A couple different things. This was particularly hard hit in, say, the 45 to 64-year-old range, sort of the baby boomer cohort, particularly with the industries that were hit with the manufacturing and the blue-collar jobs, the construction workers, things like that. That is where we've seen the least improvement. The large uptick you see in the Oregon data here, and again, it's based on a very small sample, so it's noisy, but a lot of it's coming from the 25 to 34-year-old group. The oldest half of the millennials, basically, is where we're seeing the strongest improvements here. However, the 40s and 50-year-olds are starting to improve as well. However, the growth has been strongest there, and I don't know if that's an industry mix, right? You know, software developers and urban centers and things like that has to play a role in that at some point. I don't get further.
Yeah, no, to add, I mean, some of this is still, there's still a cyclical component to this. Folks that were discouraged because of the lack of job opportunities. Right now, we're just starting to see wage growth and a tight labor market, and so some of these folks might come back in. We also saw among the young workers a whole lot of them taken off to school because of the lack of opportunities, and that's a timely process, and they'll start feeding back into the labor force as we go forward. But Josh highlighted the ones that we're really worried about. The ones we're worried about are the workers that get left behind where there's a skill disconnect. To think of an auto part worker in a little town in the Midwest who's in their 50s and well paid, and the parts plant goes out of business. Or here we look at the mill town, and the mill goes out of business and leaves a skilled 50-year-old worker with skills that don't match what the local economy has. And then these folks are divorced from the labor market for long periods of time. And so that's what we're really worried about. We're not worried about the cyclical stuff, which are people going to school. Here we have still a lot of construction and housing industry stuff that shows up as out of the labor force, but I'm not so sure that won't, you know, come back as we go forward.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could on slides 3, 4, and 5, I'm looking for a little clarification as to the relationship between, so you said on slide 5, you said any reduction in demand in China is going to hit us exceptionally hard, so that's a risk that's out there. And then slide 4 has numbers for China. I'm wondering if you feel like those are decent numbers. I've heard people say that some of the numbers coming out of China maybe aren't reliable. So if you could comment on that. And then finally on slide 3, is this specific to, you say expansions do not die of old age. Is that reference to the U.S. expansion? But Oregon still has that exposure to a slowdown in exports. or is that really talking about the Oregon expansion?
Okay. Yeah, Senator Edwards, I'll start with that one. Oregon has never survived a U.S. recession without going in one as well. We're just riding the wave here. So, but that said, whether in a recession or an expansion, when our Asian trading partners get hit harder, we're going to lose. We're going to erode relative to other states. So we're still going to go up and down this business cycle. And when we talk about the expansion is not dying of old age, we're really talking about the U.S. economic recovery, of which we're just a small part. But that said, our relative position vis-a-vis other states is impacted by how our trading partners are doing. And it's not so with just China. And in terms of China, you're right. The numbers are laughable at best, I think. If what we're seeing here were actually true, they wouldn't be devaluing their currency right now. If they were really able to easily maintain the 7% and 8% targets that they've been looking at, So my guess is we've eroded below that. Now they're cutting interest rates. They're cutting exchange rates. Obviously, being very proactive in terms of growth. So either growth is weak now, or they're afraid of growth becoming weak tomorrow. China, we talk about it a lot, but, for Oregon, in terms of our trade ties, particularly in terms of the value of our exports, it's not really China. It's the smaller Asian countries that move around with China. Their exchange rates tend to float as well. But these are part of our supply chains in Malaysia and Vietnam and whatnot. This is where our businesses send the intermediate goods to then turn into final products that come back home. And so that's where we're going to get hit. China is more of the tomorrow story. This is where we hope to sell our products in the future.
Okay. Thank you.
Question for that.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't have the slide number, but the one about the monthly receipts of personal income tax. Could you pull that up? So I just wanted to. I was curious to know, so you talked about how there was a drop after April and they weren't coming in at quite the same clip. Although, and I realize this is only 2 years, the same thing happens in 2014. Is that a fairly, and it doesn't look as significant, the drop, as the 2014 drop. So I just wondered if you had any other kind of thoughts or comments. Is that just cyclically how they come in?
Representative Warner, I wish I knew. If we went back to 2013, it was the opposite. It's amazing to me how we can get here and go in front of the legislature on May 15th and then have, all of a sudden these collections really fly around. And I think what happens is at the very end of the pile, in terms of processing, they have some big complicated returns, some of the real big money returns. And so I think some of these are big negatives, some of them are big positives. And there on those last few weeks, we've seen the needle move more than normal, particularly in the last couple, 3 years. We looked at it over the last few years. Typically, once we get into mid-May, if we're looking at 10% growth relative to the year before, that's pretty stable. But not the last couple of years. We've really shifted around and trying to get a handle on that and to what extent it foreshadows what we're going to see this fall. But, yeah, in terms of this picture, the other thing to mention is we've smoothed this over 3 months because otherwise the numbers are just way too volatile. And so this drop is, even more pronounced than you would see here if we were just looking at the May and June numbers. We're very low. But as we, average over the whole tax season, which was still a good one, when we, it just wasn't quite as good as it was looking when I sat here in May. And so, unfortunately, we've pulled a little back.
So, brief follow-up. Thank you. So we don't have the September number, well, obviously, because it's not September yet. But I would just think, again, from the year before, the late filers, you file for a quarter's worth of, 3 months' worth of delay. And so the thought / hope is that could be coming back up there as well. Correct.
Yeah, absolutely, Representative Warner. Everybody has to pay on April 15th, whether they file or not. Mm-hmm. So The accountants send out a big check to play it safe, you typically, because they don't want penalties. So they try to play it safe, and then we get into the fall and they reconcile that. And so to what extent did people make more than they thought they did in April or make less? These errors that they made in April, are they on the upside or downside? And that seems to be somewhat random from year to year. And the, you know, the best advice we get on this is when we talk to our accountants and tax lawyers and try to get an idea of what the real big ticket taxpayers are doing and try to get a sense if there's anything there. But it's very difficult because from a modeling perspective, because it's not just the economy that impacts this, it has as much to do with processing and who's taking a vacation at DOR and when, you know, what days of the week, you know, and it's a mess.
Okay, yes, Representative Benz.
Thank you. I think one of your most interesting slides is the one that shows the per capita personal income and the average wage in Oregon passing the national level. Yeah, I think you commented on that one. Yeah, that's it. Does that average wage include benefits that go with jobs, or is that just I don't know what that is. Does that include job benefits in addition to wages?
No, Representative Benz. No, this is just wages and salaries. Although when we look at broader employment cost indices at the U.S. level, they have the same pattern. So my assumption would be that you know it would look similar, but we don't have the regional data for the compensation, the non-wage compensation, health benefits, and the like.
Right. And a follow-up, if I may. There's a lot of talk about raising the minimum wage, and you mentioned that. Finally, wages are starting to trend up because of the drop in unemployment. Is that actually happening? Are people starting to make more money at the low end of the scale because of the higher employment demand? I think you mentioned that earlier, and I just wanted you to elaborate on it.
Yes, Representative Benz. I haven't sliced up wage growth across occupations because of the data limitations, but nevertheless, it's certainly clear that, you know, this wage growth is not uniform across industries or occupations, right? There are highly in-demand occupations where we're seeing more wage growth in terms of a lot of these professional services and whatnot and technical services and the like. We're seeing the fastest wage growth. And even in some of the lower wage occupations, we're seeing some, but it's not universal. So I don't know. I haven't added it up.
No, and last time I was looking at some of these, if you look at retail and leisure and hospitality, which do have more of a disproportionate share of minimum wage workers, their average gains within those sectors are more along the lines of inflation, probably partially because our minimum wage is tied to inflation. But I haven't looked in the last 6 months or so.
Thank you.
Okay, Josh and Mark, thank you very much for this presentation.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Committees, let's take a brief break. We've been running all morning, raucous and ragged, without any rules whatsoever, so it's time to end that.
No rules. Do you want him to explain them or not? There's nothing changed, right, Mr. Warner?
That's correct, Mr. Vice Chair. The rules that you have before you are the same as last interim. The reference I made to the House was on the last one, number 7, same issue there in terms of bill introduction. So those are the same rules you had adopted last interim.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the rules till next time we decide to change it.
Senator Burke was smooth. We adopt the rules. Discussion, objections, so ordered. All right, so
the House Committee on Revenue will come back to order for the purpose of their next hearing.
We'll take a look at the kicker and some of the technical issues surrounding the kicker with Deanna from the Department of Revenue.
Good morning.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Dr. Warner.
Just a couple of introductory issues. One thing of business is that please give us your per diem. If you haven't done so, give it to Corinne. So I know we'll get back into the interim mode to make sure that you remember to do that. I did want to just say a comment about the Department of Revenue and the technical issues. keep in mind that, that the kicker statutes have changed considerably over the last decade. And so we have some issues coming up and that deal with consistency in those statutes. And the other thing to keep in mind is that we have not had a personal kicker since 2007, as Mark McMullen was telling you. And so we've had an extended period there. We've actually had a series of changes in that period. So this is the first time we've gone back to the process in quite a while. And so this is an issue that came up as Department of Revenue was looking at how to process this 2015 kicker.
For the record, Deanna Mack with the Department of Revenue, and as Paul just outlined, that's exactly right. Since 1995, you folks have changed the kicker laws 13 times to deal with different things, such as changing it from a credit to a check, changing it back to a credit, looking at basing the credit on the current year tax liability versus the prior year tax liability in which it is now, whether it's based on tax before credits, tax after credits. There's been a slew of different things. You've also enacted an opportunity for folks to donate their kicker to the state school fund back in 1999, which was great when we had a check. Like Paul said, as this is the first kicker that we've issued since 2007, and there have been a multitude of changes since 2011. And as a result of those changes, we believe that there is some inconsistency in the 305 state school fund donation language and the 291, Chapter 291 language in the kicker, specifically related to when a taxpayer owes a debt to the state. Current statutes now have some ambiguous language as to what is to happen with the kicker if a taxpayer elects to donate to the state school fund and they also owe a debt to the state. Right now, it's unclear who we would issue the kicker payment to if the taxpayer elects to donate his check, if they also owe a debt to the state, and there's a remainder. So there isn't an issue when there is the debt owed exceeds the kicker. As they still have a balance, we would keep it all. It's the case where the kicker is more than the amount that they owe. It's unclear whether we would issue the remainder to the taxpayer or directly to the state school fund. Historically, when we had the check, we would issue the remainder directly to the state school fund, and we believe that is what you would still want us to do. And the issue is one of timing for us. Right now, we're programming our systems, and we are software vendors, your business community, programming their systems to deal with the return filings that are coming up in January. So we need to adopt an emergency rule in order to allow us to do that work. But we wanted to get a nod from the legislature, basically, that is, in fact, what your policy intent was, that we would still continue to offset as per required in Chapter 291 and then also issue the remainder directly to the state school fund rather than interpret it as having the amount, that action having voided their election and having to issue the payment directly to the taxpayer. So we have consulted with LRO and with legislative council. We are all in agreement generally that was kind of a holdover from all of the multitude of changes in the past 15 years, 20 years, I guess. And that we would like that nod if that is what you folks intend so that we can go ahead with an emergency rule and then work with you in February to actually have the statutes cleaned up and aligned so that they don't have incongruous result. And with that, if you have any questions.
Any head nods? Any questions, Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I understand that the dilemma you faced, it has to do with the ambiguity in the way the statutes fit together, if right. I've got that right. I think it's the state policy, and I'd love comments from other members of the two committees, that we do the offsets first. That is that we whatever debts you're collecting, whether it's other funds owed to the department or funds that are owed to other departments, or funds that are owed for child support, for example, if that's one of those mm-hmm. that you're allowed to collect, so that people custodial parents actually receive their child support, that those should be paid first.
Correct.
And then if there's anything left, then it either goes back to the taxpayer as a credit, or if they elect to contribute to the school fund, then it would go to the school fund. That would be my preference for how to do it. I don't know what other members of the committee think, and I would hope that you will come, if you think that there really is an ambiguity in the statute, if the department believes that you'll come back and ask the 16th session for a clarification and a correction, either going backwards to cover what you've done already, or at least going forward for the next time this occurs.
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct. And just to clarify, we do not see any ambiguity in the fact that we have to offset. We do believe that is very clear, and it's been longstanding practice. The question is when they, what happens to the remainder, if there is a remainder, because the statute that allows for the state school fund says if it's used at all to pay in their calculation of tax liability, if that kicker is used in that way, then it voids the election to donate to the state school fund. So one reasonable interpretation is that we have to send the remainder directly to the taxpayer, which is inconsistent with historic practice. And so that's where we wanted clarification is, do you want us to send the remainder directly to the state school fund, which has been our practice for, you know, as long as the state school fund election has been in place, or do you want us to send the remainder to the taxpayer, which is one reasonable interpretation of the statute.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, could I just follow up briefly? Thank you. I really appreciate that clarification. The only question then is, if you use some of this money for offset, is the transfer to the school fund election void or not?
Correct.
And my view would be that if a person actually wants funds to go to the school fund, we ought to honor that election after you've taken care of the offsets. But that's only my personal opinion. I don't have any idea what the rest of the committees think about that.
Okay. Senator Boquist.
Thank you. Question of Mr. Warner. So that I understand here, since we can't buy in future legislation, what we're really talking about is that we're trying to get on the record what the opinions are of the legislators so that it gives some guidance to the Department of Revenue, because these must be issued before we go into the February session. Right. And then in the February session, we would need to have a committee bill, and hopefully whatever we all thought in our opinions today or whatever would be honored by our colleagues in the legislature, and we'd make that technical correction in the February session. Is that not correct?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair. The department, it needs to act now, because they've got a kicker, they've got a process, and you won't be in a position to pass new statutory authority or clean up statute between now and February. So what they're looking for is just to, and we've talked with them about, does this look like a reasonable approach? And if there's something that raises a red flag with the Revenue Committee members, then, you know, they should know that now so they can make some adjustments. In terms of how we would proceed, I would think that it would be a committee bill that could be introduced that would clarify that statute, because, again, as Deanna said, we have gone through a series of changes about what year the liability is, about going back to a credit. Now you've got a number of issues around, because it's the prior year, it's 14 is what this is based on. So there's a series of issues, and maybe we need to review those as well. But I think it makes a lot of sense to make sure those statutes are consistent.
Follow up, just for clarity then. So if an offset, what we're basically arguing is, if an offset occurs for a given taxpayer, that the taxpayer, after the offset calculation is done, if there is a remaining credit balance, the taxpayer would have the option of either giving it to the school fund or taking it back to themselves. That's the real discussion, right?
That's correct. They would express that option on their return.
Okay, and I am fine with that. Thank you.
Further comments or questions? Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just how often do you anticipate this is going to come up?
That's a good question. Mr. Chair, Representative Vince, I know in 2007 we had just under 12,000 kicker donations to the state school fund. So it would be some subset of that population of people. We don't think it's very many, but out of, you know, the almost 2 million returns that we see. But it will happen, and we just need to have that guidance in the legislative intent in the record so we can adopt that emergency rule.
I'll just join Senator Boquist with his analysis, as same as mine.
And just follow up to anyone, just for clarity, the subset is 12,000 of the school fund, and of that we don't know what would be an offset, but I would assume an offset might be a significantly smaller portion of the 12,000.
Correct.
Thank you. I'm still fine.
Representative Nunes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Are we all supposed to say what we think and then that provides direction to the agency?
Or do
the chairs just assume
for all of us?
I appreciate that.
Or you let your vice chairs go under the knife.
Should we caucus?
I appreciate that question on this scenario because this hardly ever happens. So what I would ask is there anyone here who disagrees or is troubled by the remedy, than the emergency rule that the Department of Revenue would like to pursue? And I don't see or hear anybody objecting.
I have a question.
Representative Davis has a question.
Thank you. What's the statutory site again for the two conflicting provisions?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davis, the two statutes, the kicker statute is ORS 291.349, and the state school fund donation is ORS 305.792.
Don't wait for me.
I'm
a lawyer. The clock's running right now. So.
All right. Well, if somebody is troubled or objects, we can still talk about that, I guess, in December down the road. But for now, I don't know if this is a signal or not, but you're not hearing any objections to the proposal that you outlined.
Okay. All right. No. Thank you.
Thank you.
And to really answer your question, normally they come back and beg forgiveness. They never ask us in advance.
In my career, that's actually just a summary up here. And
all right.
Chris,
Chris and Dr. Warner are going to go through the legislation that we passed this session and hit the highlights, the ramifications, and remind us what it was we did. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go through the document that we prepare at the end of each session. And one of the things I've found over time is usually legislators don't want to talk too much about what they've just done. There's kind of I think they've kind of seen enough of some of these bills and issues. But just this is a summary. And we found, at least I found it personally very useful for when you go back over time, especially look back several biennium, thinking here, what were the key measures that were passed? What were the key revenue issues? And give you a summary and kind of remind you. And I think that's probably its most useful function. A couple of things we do on this is it has all of what we consider to be revenue bills, not just revenue impacts, but what we consider to be revenue bills, most of which came through one or both of the revenue committees. But we have some other things included as well, like the state school fund allocation, for example. We do all of the analysis on how that's distributed to the individual districts. So we'll include all of that information. So it's broken into our categories that we usually work in, our subject areas. Initially, at the front of the document is kind of a revenue policy review overview, where we go through and try to highlight what we consider to be the revenue environment at the time. And of course, you know, the key change in this overall environment compared to the recent sessions, particularly 09, 11, and 13, was that we're into a more stable economic environment where you do have some revenue growth out there that we hadn't seen for a considerable period of time. And that did limit, I think, some of the more budget-oriented revenue measures. You ended up with a fairly modest changes to the close of session estimate. You saw those numbers in the state economist presentation. Most of the revenue changes that took place were through these fund shifts, and the largest one actually being the change in the gain share program that had a significant impact on what dollars were available for general fund purposes, but really no impact on what gross revenue was. So fairly minor changes. The key legislation that we thought to highlight in terms of what were the major revenue bills of the session, the first was the omnibus bill that you both committees spent a great deal of time on in the joint committee, because that had a lot of policy decisions embedded in that. And that, of course, will be the subject of our credit discussions that Chris will get into. The second one was Senate Bill 611, which was the central assessment bill, and that will be something we'll be monitoring closely to see how that's implemented, and that another issue that you spent a considerable time on. Senate Bill 129 was the revision of the gain share program and extension of the program out to 2024. That, of course, the biggest change there was it capped the amount of revenue going to an individual county to $16 million, and that had a significant impact on the split between general fund and gain share revenue. 2041 did not come through the revenue committees, but this was the tax mechanism for the Measure 91 and the Marijuana Committee. Of course, we have esteemed members of that committee here. Spent a lot of time on that. Mazin did the staff work on those revenue estimates. And that, of course, is a key issue going forward and something we'll be watching very closely, how that revenue stream comes in. And anytime you're dealing with a new revenue base, it's obviously a lot of uncertainty, and this one is more than usual. And then finally, 61 is the tax haven law. Didn't have a significant revenue impact, but we've spent a lot of time on discussing that and what the overall policy intent was. So we put that in there as one. I've already been contacted again by Colorado state legislative staff talking about revenue estimates for them, because they're really seriously looking at this something similar as they have in the past. So those are the ones the highlights. The other thing I would say, just kind of an overview, is that if you look kind of through by the subject areas over the recent sessions, I didn't do a count, but certainly the impression has been in recent sessions, the dominant subject area has been income tax, personal income tax and corporate income tax. And if you look at the index here, we only have about a half a page on the personal and corporate income tax bills. So less activity in that area. Certainly a lot of policies embedded in 2171, the tax credit bill, that were related to the income tax. But overall, in terms of kind of tweaks to the income tax, a lot fewer than what we've seen in recent sessions. So where we did see the increased activities, and I'm concerned that Kyle's agent's going to contact me for a wage increase based on the workload on the property tax area. The property tax reemerged kind of as an issue, I think, in terms of the revenue committee, compared to where we had been in kind of the post-Measure 50 world of stability, that we saw a lot more issues around the property tax. And that may be a coming trend going forward. And then we also saw a lot more kind of miscellaneous issues around bonding and debt, marijuana issues, a lot of court fee, judicial issues. So these all affect the revenue system in kind of different ways. So we're hoping that this document is useful to you. As usual, it's priced competitively. So you're certainly welcome to use that if you have any questions of it. What I thought we would, unless there are any questions on that document itself, I would turn it over to Chris, who was going to go through some background on the tax credit process, kind of looking at it retrospectively. And we thought it would be a good time to do that now, because you've gone through a complete nine-year cycle. Remember how we, in 2009, when we first broke up the credits into sunset dates, you had three groups. Well, you've just completed the first round of covering all those three groups. So now you can look back over three sessions of history on kind of decisions you've made, and then kind of get some previews of what lies ahead for this interim and eventually into 17.
Six-year cycle. Yeah.
Six-year. Well, it's really three groups, 2 years, so I'm thinking 9 years. So, but 6 years in terms of legislative time, yeah.
For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So in OLIS, there is a document called Tax Credit Review History. And in keeping with line with the comment Paul just made, this is just a high-level review of the tax credit review process. So I've just tried to put together some baseline statistics of that process. And in part for some of the new members, a review here. This goes back to 2009 when House Bill 2067.
Say $59.
Not sure what that was. Was passed, and it assigned a sunset date to 50 of the 53 active tax credits and put them into three groups, sunsetting in 2012, 2014, and 2016. The three tax credits that did not have a sunset put on them are the personal exemption tax credit, the credit for taxes paid to other states, and a claim of right income, basically because those are considered part of the base structure of the tax system and not really a policy decision tax credits. So then in the 11, 13, and 15 sessions where when each of those groups of tax credits was reviewed, and just in summary, in 2011, 22 tax credits were reviewed. 10 were allowed to sunset, 9 were extended and or modified, 2 were restructured into 4 tax credits, and that's the Betsy credit right there. And then one new one was created.
Is this?
And then in 2013, you had 14 credits reviewed, 5 sunset, and 9 were extended and or modified. And then in 2015, 18 credits were considered, and 9 were allowed to sunset, and 7 were extended and or modified, and then 2 were restructured into 1. And I didn't go into a lot of detail, but there almost every variety of policy change that can happen to the tax credits. You had some tax credits that were actually sunset early to use the revenue in other areas, either through a direct appropriation or to pay for the extension of other tax credits. And then we had the merging of tax credits and the restructuring, which arguably was the larger policy intent in 2009 to deliberately review the process of tax credit policy. The chart here aligns to that, the 2009 concept, where the blue line is the personal exemption tax credit and the red bars are the credit for taxes paid to the other states. So while in total tax credits are upwards of $1 billion a year, the largest chunk of that is by and far and away the personal exemption tax credit. So we get questions a lot about the cost of tax credits being $1.5 to $2 billion a biennium and policies that can be changed to reduce those costs. Inevitably, the discussion turns to the personal exemption tax credit, and the committee has made changes, the legislature has made changes to that tax credits, but most of the sunset review process refers to the green barred tax credits, which are all of the other tax credits. And so this chart, the upshot of the tax credit review process in terms of revenue impact, I have two lines here, the blue line and the red line. And the blue line I labeled in quotes 2009 law. And so what I did try to do here was go back to 2009 and look at all of the active tax credits, the 50 or so tax credits, part of the review process, and figure out what their projected cost would be up through 2030. And it's almost an implicit policy the way the legislature handled tax credits before, where they would come up for sunset and then they would just almost automatically be renewed without a lot of investigation as to the policy intent and so forth. Now, some of the tax credits actually did have sunset dates in 2009 prior to 2067, but I ignored those for the purposes here, trying to get at that larger issue of how the legislature almost implicitly handled tax credits prior to this process. And then the red bar is the explicit process of tax credit reviews. And so you can see the annual revenue savings as it's projected out through 2030. And then the table in the middle here is just a tally of the number of active tax credits. By active, I mean these are tax credits that are on the books that people can claim for the first time in a given year. So in 2009, there were 51 tax credits, and over the past three sessions, the legislature has allowed 26 of them to sunset and created 7 of them, so that today there are 32 active tax credits. And the only one tax credit I've included in the presentation here is the Betsy. I still get a lot of questions about the use of this tax credit. And this is a chart I presented last summer at the time where it shows the amount claimed for the Betsy credit and the amount used. And I expect that we're just about at the annual peak of the tax credits being claimed and used. So that red amount, so the most recent data is 2012, where the amount claimed was about $200 million. and the amount used was about $125 million. So we have actual data for personal taxpayers up through 2013 and corporate taxpayers through 2012. So we're right at the cusp of where I think we're going to start seeing the decline, the annual decline in the amount of tax credits used. And so that's the only one I really included on here. And that's a big driver in this red line falling over here, is the handling of the Betsy tax credit. And the last table
Mr.
here.
Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to this Betsy claimed and used piece, I've always been of the impression, and probably bad memory, that the significant change in this credit took place as a result of the 2007 law. But I noticed that the change of the slope occurred well before that. And I assume that had to do with some other such other issues other than the 2007 law. If you recall, would you mind giving us two or three sentences on that?
Chair Barnhart. I think a lot of that had to do with federal policy and a lot of things that were going on in the energy field at the time. And one of the challenges, as the members know, in any session when you're dealing with policy, there's a lag on tax return data that we have. So the changes that were being considered in 2007, we did not have clean 2005 and 2006 data at the time. So it wasn't clear that there was already this uptick at the same time the policy changes were being made in 2007. So in a real sense, there was a compounding effect of the policy changes, which really helped it cause it to explode. And again, getting back partially for new members, the Betsy credit was a five-year credit. So while the amount of tax credits issued was in the neighborhood of $1 billion, that doesn't hit in 1 year. It's spread out over a number of years. So there wasn't a one-year spike in 2007. So.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. And thank you, Chris, for all your work on all of this. Looking at your green line then, still looking at the Betsy, you can see the curtailment. Is that the moment of recognition that things were going awry there on the green line? Is that what happened? I'm going back to 2009 now, and I remember sitting in this room and seeing what was happening, and then the work began to try to regain control, if you will, of this program. And so at least when it did become apparent, we did something, and this line so indicate. Yeah. But there's quite a tail on these things.
Yes, and in 2009, the challenge of a discussion like this is getting at the perspective. And for example, the blue line up here tries to get at what we thought in 2009. So some of the program caps were not in place in 2009. And so arguably those would have kept growing. What would have served as a cap would have been the ability of the tax system to absorb the use of the tax credits. I remember at the time a lot of the pre-certs were $1 billion in pre-certification for tax credits, and there was a lot of concern that it would wipe out the entire corporate tax liability. And while at a high level that number it could work, but the chances of every corporation claiming buying a Betsy and using that tax credit were pretty minimal. So that blue line was that perspective of no cap on the program and it continuing to grow. The difference between the red and the green here, this does reflect the policy changes that were made in 2008, 2009, and 2010, because these are actuals. To the left of this vertical blue line are actuals, and then to the right are my projections for how the existing Betsy tax credits will play out over time. And a number of factors can affect those. When if we slip into a recession, the use of these tax credits will go down. Taxpayers who experience large capital gains might be able to offset those gains with the Betsy. And so that's why you have 09, 10, and 11, there's a kind of a jagged use of the tax credits. It's not a smooth use. It depends on the liability of the taxpayers.
Chris, for the benefit of some of our newer members, could you explain the basic difference between claimed and used?
Chair Haas. The amount taxpayers, if they have earned a tax credit and they're allowed so I'm a taxpayer and I'm allowed to use a $1 million tax credit. I'm supposed to fill that out on the tax return, claim my $1 million in tax credit. If my gross tax, which is the tax due before credits, is only $800,000. I claim my $1 million in tax credits, but I only use $800,000 of that tax credit. And then the $200,000 that I can't use that year, I ostensibly can carry that forward to the next year. And so one of the subtleties about this red line is that there's a lot of double counting in the red line, in that in 1 year, the difference between the red and the green is the amount that can't be used in that year, and then I will claim that again the following year. And so at the end of the day, they'll converge. But that's why the red line is so much higher, because I can carry forward tax credits for 5 years, and then I've claimed those same tax credits for 5 years until I can use them all.
Five.
Okay. And this is the closest thing I have to a lot of detail, and I won't go through this, but for each of the sessions, 2011, 13, and 15, these are the tax credits that were considered by the legislature in those years. The crossed out tax credits were the ones that have sunset. And below here, we have a couple credits were either created or extended in the even year session. For example, the Reservation Enterprise Zone tax credit had an original sunset date of 2012. In 2009, in the 2010 legislature, it was extended. The italicized tax credits were the ones that were created in that year. So, for example, in 2011, here's the Betsy Energy tax credit was eliminated, and it was replaced with the conservation, renewable energy, transportation, and manufacturing tax credits down here. And so each of these groups for the 3 years, it's just a listing of the tax credits that were allowed to continue or sunset. And I mentioned earlier about almost every flavor of possible policy change. Crop gleaning was eliminated in 2011. It was allowed to sunset. It was reestablished in 2014.
Hmm. Senator Bocas.
So, Chris, generally speaking, the 2011 list is going to be up again in 2017.
Correct. Okay. And that actually leads, there's another document in OLIS, the tax credit sunset 7/13/2015. This, I think, the format will look familiar for returning members. And this is the first draft of the cost to extend the tax credits. And in this document, we have this first group. And just as Vice Chair Boquist mentioned, those that were extended in 2011 are up again. So these are mainly the, I think broadly, these have been referred to as business development tax credits. You have the energy tax credits, you have the qualified research tax credit, and so forth. And then the rural medical tax credit continues to be extended 2 years at a time, so it'll be up for review again. And I should note.
Wait, this time.
It's what? What'd you say?
It's probably going to go away this time because they have an alternative plan that the doctors are working on. So hopefully it will be a better plan that's self-financing. So the benefit will remain and the credit will go away. That's the theory. Yeah. At least that's what they preach to us on the floor. So.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, well, we'll see.
I would note just about these estimates, these are very preliminary. I haven't really looked at these in detail. I do keep track of tax credit information from DOR on the tax return. So these are largely just trended numbers in place here. So these could change a good bit. At the moment, the cost for extending this group of tax credits is, I have that at just under $40 million, but that could change a good bit here as I get into reviewing the detail of these tax credits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chris, thank you again for this. I never cease to be amazed by your ability to take a ton of information and make it both very concise yet very understandable. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
On the 2020 ones, did you just do that to give us a little sneak preview for the session after or as well, or are these particular ones?
These are all of them. The document goes on to the second page.
Okay, it's, okay.
This is just all of them. This has become kind of almost a standard document for us.
Yep.
And I can go into more detail. I'm not sure. I think it might be self-explanatory or at least familiar at this point. But I just did want to give a heads up. The numbers could change dramatically here as I get into the details of each of the tax credits. And that was it that I had for the tax credit process.
Okay, thank you. This is interesting. Have any questions on the tax credit process? You answered all of the questions.
And it wasn't even painful this time.
Yeah. Dr. Warner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all we have for the committees today. Wow. So we'll let you take an early break. And get ready for, and to remind you that during the legislative days, the committees will be meeting separately. The Senate committee will meet on the first day at 2 in the afternoon, the House committee 8, the second day of legislative days.
In the morning?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, before we go, I just want to thank everybody who's come out in the middle of the summer, the days of August, to attend this meeting, and all the members, and congratulate new members of the House committee. I was very appreciative to have you on board as we do our interim work. I would also, just as a personal note that I at the hotel this morning where I was having breakfast, I saw three members of the South Carolina, I believe, Forestry Department in uniform. I'm suspicious that they're here in some capacity having to do with the conflagrations of Oregon and Washington, and I'm sure we all are wishing our firefighters well and hope that they're able to get these blazes under control and get the smoke out of our valley and out of our state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With no other business before us, we will adjourn.
The House committee is adjourned.
Adjourn.
The House committee is adjourned.